Good evening, everybody. This is Black Rock Radio number 152, and you're returning here with Len Ostanek and Anita Langley in the studio. And we have online Professor Garth Nicholson. Can you hear us, Professor Nicholson?
Yes, I can.
Wonderful. Well, we had you here a long time ago, and it was very interesting, very, very interesting hearing you talk about vaccines. And we were hoping that you could bring us up to date on what you've been doing the last couple of years. And we never really got to talk much about Gulf War Syndrome, and I know you had a big role, and I understand perhaps an ongoing role in investigating what's been going on with that. So perhaps we could just start off with a little bit of an update of where you've been the last couple of years.
Well, in the last year or so, we've actually published a number of papers, and we've worked quite hard on the families of Gulf War veterans who've come down with illness since the veterans returned home. And our study, one of our studies, was just published in the Journal of Chronic Fatigue Syndrome, where we studied some 120 patients. And these were family members who, 145 patients, and these were family members of veterans who came home and became sick with Gulf War illness. And an interesting part of it is that at least half the family members also became sick with very similar illnesses. And what we documented in the study was that the veterans had a chronic infection, mostly Mycoplasma fermentans, a very unusual microorganism, which I'll come back to in a moment. And slowly but surely, this infection passed to family members. The family members that became sick, over 85% of them had the same infection. And the interesting thing about that was that a number of years ago we claimed that really there was no such thing as a new Gulf War syndrome, that is a new syndrome associated with service in the Gulf during the war. We said it was more related to chronic fatigue syndrome, and we called it Gulf War illness. And in fact, this study bears that out, because the immediate family members who never served in the Gulf, they were diagnosed with chronic fatigue syndrome or fibromyalgia syndrome. And interestingly, their children who came down sick were diagnosed mostly with autism, because before they get to really be teenagers, most children, when they get this type of infection, will exhibit autistic behavior. And so I thought it was a very interesting study, and it really showed and confirmed that the illnesses can be passed to immediate family members, even though there's a tremendous denial going on about this.
Now, you mentioned a tremendous denial. Have you found that that positions have changed at all in the government the last couple of years, or are you still finding the same wall you're running up against?
Well, I think there's, among certain quarters, the same wall is still there, and it's just simply been replastered over. For example, the Navy captain who was head of the Gulf War illness section in the Pentagon retired, but then he came back to this head the same section. And this was a person who was a specialist in biologic warfare and was trained in biological warfare and so on. And I always use the analogy of having the rabbits guard the lettuce patch. Having a person like this handle something like Gulf War illnesses, I thought, was a tremendous conflict of interest. And so really not much has changed in certain quarters, although I think we've made a certain amount of headway with the line officers and the general officers who are really responsible for their troops, for their soldiers, for their Marines and sailors, rather than the medical corps, who really don't have that same responsibility.
Well, if I have to look at the number of military people who've questioned some of the vaccines that have come up more recently, I have to suggest that perhaps you've been very good at getting your information across, at least to some of these key people, as you mentioned, because ultimately their responsibility is to their own, through their troops, and everybody has to be able to live with themselves in the end.
We've said for a long time, for example, that the vaccines were a major problem, and in fact, I just spoke on this at a major conference, the annual conference of the American Academy of Environmental Medicine, of which I'm a member. And one of the papers that I gave was really this family study that I just mentioned at that particular meeting. And when it came right down to, you know, what was the original cause of it, there were a number of other studies that point to the vaccines. And the reason for this was that some of the soldiers were vaccinated but not deployed, and many of them also came down with the same illness that the deployed forces came down with. And so the only explanation was is that they got the vaccines, they got ill, compared to other non-deployed soldiers and Marines who were not vaccinated and didn't get illness. So, you know, although the non-deployed forces who were vaccinated didn't get illness to the same degree, that is the same frequency, they nonetheless had very high rates of chronic illness like chronic fatigue syndrome compared to their counterparts that didn't receive the vaccines. So there are actually two studies in the United Kingdom and a couple studies in the United States, particularly by an epidemiologist who works for the state of Kansas, Leah Steele. And Dr. Steele did a couple of studies on all the Kansas veterans and found this association, a very statistically significant association between the vaccines and Gulf War illness. So there is a big arrow pointing towards the vaccines, but of course this has not changed the strategy of the U.S. Armed Forces yet. But it has changed the strategy in our allies. A number of countries that were using vaccines, particularly American vaccines, have now stopped using them. Principally Canada, Australia, and even the United Kingdom, they've quietly sort of retired these vaccines and not given these vaccines to their forces that were deployed, for example, to Iraq recently. And so there has been a change in philosophy, at least in our allies, although this hasn't quite made it to the Pentagon, and I think because it's so deeply ingrained in the philosophy of counter-biologic warfare, and it's too bad. Now, recently I've been in contact with the French forces, and of course one of the interesting aspects of the Gulf War was that the French forces barely had any Gulf War illness cases that were reported. They had a few, but they were barely any. And interestingly enough, the French forces did not use vaccines to counter Iraqi biological warfare threats. They used the prophylactic antibiotics like doxycycline. They didn't come down with illness. And interestingly enough, there were a few units that were experimental units that were given doxycycline. They did not come down, to my knowledge, with Gulf War illness. So I think the military knows what went wrong, and certainly the medical corps knows what went wrong in the Gulf War. But unfortunately, they're making some of the same mistakes in Iraq that we made in the last Gulf War. Maybe not to the same degree and not to the same extent, but they're still making those same mistakes. And the vaccines are one of the biggest mistakes.
There's something here that disturbs me about vaccines in particular. I printed up a few of the product, so-called inserts or information pamphlets from some of the vaccine manufacturers today. And with respect to this, there's a statement here, which I find rather common with these inserts, to paraphrase, the cells, virus pools, fetal bovine serum, and human albumin are all screened for the absence of adventitious agents. Now, I have to ask you, how far along are we in our ability to recognize these adventitious agents that we could be arrogant enough to think that we can actually screen for everything harmful that could be in those?
Well, they don't screen for a lot of things. As a matter of fact, I asked a vaccine manufacturer, why don't they screen for things like mycoplasmas and other very slow-growing bacteria? He sort of looked at me and said, you want to put us out of business? And so it's a matter of economics for them. If they have to screen for all these different things that could potentially be in the vaccines, then they feel that they could make a profit. And so they don't want to do it. And so they do minimal testing. And they generally test for very rapidly growing bacteria and a few viruses when they do testing, but they don't test for a lot of things, and I think that's a shame.
Now, you say minimal testing. I have to endorse what you just said, because I'm looking at this one diphtheria and tetanus toxoids absorbed USP, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. This particular vaccine, it says, was the clinical study was performed in 20 children. 20 children?
Well,
that's a vaccine study?
I'm not going to defend the practices of the vaccine companies and the things that they do, because I just don't think that a lot of what's done is right. And I think it's leading to our explosive incidents of autism and other problems that we've had in our society, not just with our veterans, but also with our civilians. And because of, I think, the practices of trying to get each vaccine shot as cheap as possible, they're cutting corners, and I think this is going to cause us problems. They will never admit it, and you'll never get them to admit that things may not be as rosy as they paint them, but I think that's probably going to turn out to be the case. So I really have to say that we really need to clean up our act when it comes to vaccines. I'm not saying the vaccines are bad. I'm just saying that we need better quality control to ensure that we're not giving contaminated vaccines to anyone.
Yeah, I mean, there's contaminated. There's also a few things that I think are often overlooked. For example, these inserts always indicate that there are contraindications for vaccines, yet I don't recall a doctor ever asking me if I had a family history of convulsions or anything along those lines. And individual or family histories of convulsions is a rather common contraindication that I see in these vaccines.
There are a number of counterindications for vaccines, and you're right. I mean, it's rare that people are given a proper history before they're inoculated, particularly these mass inoculations, like, for example, against the influenza. And I know, for example, my parents, they're in an HMO, and they're being pushed into taking the flu vaccine, and they said, well, wait a minute. We don't know if this is safe to take at our age, and it could cause us problems. And, then they just get a lot of flack and a lot of BS, frankly. There are some people that are beginning to question some of the problems with things like vaccines. And again, I want to stress to people, it's not that all vaccines are bad. That's not the case. But we do need to identify the vaccine lots that are contaminated, that are bad, and remove them, because they're causing us a lot of problems. And it's not just the vaccines. Often it's the schedule that the vaccines are given in. And I think this is one of the problems that we have with autism. We give so many vaccines to children in a very short period of time that this is very immune suppressing, and they can get opportunistic infections, and they can get sensitivity because of some of the heavy metals that might be present in the vaccines and other considerations. And this, I think, may be the number one culprit in causing autism and autistic children, and also attention deficit hyperactivity disorder. So I know people don't like to talk about this, but in fact there are a number of studies that point to these problems.
Yeah, well, you know, I mean, there have been lots of indications. Homeopathic type treatments have involved small amounts of toxins to treat and you know, alert the immune system. And there's no argument that allergies can be fought using such techniques. And there seems to be a lot of good science behind certain aspects of vaccines. But what you indicate and what I see when I look at this is so much irresponsibility in how they're put together. When you're putting mercury in there and aluminum in there using animal tissues to grow stuff and all these possible things that are littered in there with it, it's not enough to say I want to be protected against something. You've got to ask what you're going to be assaulted by. As it's almost like a Faustian trade.
Yeah, I think what's going on is we're getting these cocktails where you're not getting just the flu vaccine, you're getting 17 things at once.
Well, this is the point I was bringing up, is that often now because of the combination of different vaccines, that they're trying to put a number of different vaccines together as one, and, again, whenever you do this, then you potentially have the problem that a contaminant can slip in and so on and so forth. It's also, I think, a matter, as I said before, the scheduling. Pediatricians are being pushed to administer more and more vaccines at an earlier and earlier age. And I think this is going to have devastating effects on our children if we allow this thing to get totally out of hand, out of control.
Do you philosophically think that there may be cases where a vaccine is better for a person for developing an immune response against something than actually letting the immune system run its course in a natural way? I mean, do you think there are possibly cases where it is advantageous if you had the ideal situation with vaccines and you knew they were clean?
In the ideal situation, I'm very much for vaccines, and I think they're an excellent way to provide immunity to individuals. But that's a simplistic viewpoint. Because we're much more complicated than that, and in fact the vaccines are much more complicated than that. So I think in a real world you have to be a little bit leery of the claims that are being made by the vaccine manufacturers and so on. And again, I'm not anti-vaccine. Quite the contrary, I'm very pro-vaccine. And in fact, I just published a paper on vaccine development with a number of my colleagues. So I'm not anti-vaccine, but I am against the way in which many of the commercial vaccines are being prepared and used, and also the schedules of vaccines are being used. Too many of them are being used at once or in a more or less a truncated schedule where they're they're pushed together without allowing time for the immune system to recover before being assaulted again by another vaccine. And so you have to be, I think, more careful than we're being right now in the use of vaccines. And also we have a tremendous heterogeneity in our populations that are being vaccinated, and that's really not taken into careful account during these studies that are performed for safety purposes.
Well, I think it's very important to actually get your perspective on how you feel about vaccines in general, because there is a school of thought people are either for or against, and it's important to be able to say, no, there's a difference. It's one thing to say that vaccines are safe all the time. It's another thing to say, no, they're not safe all the time. They're safe in principle if you exercise all the appropriate precautions and make sure they aren't littered full of stuff, and then they're a very good idea. So it actually makes it harder to argue with you for somebody who says, oh no, you got to have your vaccine all the time. Well, if you're not saying vaccines are evil, period, then you're actually arguing about the science behind how they're made. And that is a very important distinction, because I know it's easy for those of us who don't really understand something like this to just throw up our hands and say, universally, okay, vaccines are out. I've had to really think about this hard myself, you know, two young children, and a lot of pressure from doctors to get them vaccinated because they were born premature and they're susceptible, supposedly, to a lot of extra things. But I still had to put my foot down and say no, because of all these things I've read on the pamphlet inserts and all the contraindications that nobody ever advised me about. And I know that, you know, one of their cousins had 45-minute grand mal seizures as an infant. Nobody asked me if there was a family history there. And it really sets my alarm bells going. And as somebody personally who has fibromyalgia, and what you say about fibromyalgia, I just think, you know, this could be devastating for my kids. I do understand, though, that there are people out there that for their own reasons might have very serious concerns about a particular illness, and everybody's got to make their own decision. It would sure be nice to know that we were dealing with clean vaccines to start with. It would make the whole thing a lot easier for everybody.
Well, I think it would. It would clarify the situation tremendously. But again, there's always a downside whenever you do a program like this. There are always risks and benefits, and you have to weigh those. In fact, one of the reasons I was a little late for your show was that I'm the vice chairman of what's called an IRB committee, an institutional review board, that really looks at patient safety in clinical trials. And we have to look at that very carefully and weigh benefits and risk. And so I think everyone has to weigh the benefits versus the risk when it comes to things like this. We have a responsibility to our families, to our children, to our society, to be very careful about the ways that we approach these sorts of major questions.
Yeah, and I tell you, I don't know when I ever felt more of a dilemma about something like this, because in my gut feeling said, vaccines no, but I'm looking at my children and I'm going, they are known to be susceptible to lung problems because they spent their first 3 months of their lives intubated. And I, 3 months I had, doctors lined up one after another giving me the spiels about vaccines. And in the end I said, well, look, you bring your literature, I'll bring mine, and we'll compare notes. And if you can argue with me, you can talk me into it, I'll change my mind. But until then, no. They brought their literature, and all their literature did was enforce what I had to say. Contraindicated for this, contraindicated for that, and I just decided no. And thank goodness, I guess, from where I'm looking now, they've had a very healthy first 16 months of their lives. Well, since they've been home, very healthy, exceptionally so. But still, the pressure was enormous. And for somebody who was resolved and somewhat educated about it, I felt myself swerving.
But not only that, didn't you have these discussions with nurses and doctors, and then as you read back,
yes,
they had no idea.
Actually, and in more than one case, I pulled out these product inserts that one resident doctor had been so kind to bring to me, and I pulled these inserts out, and I used them to argue my case, and I'm going, it's right here in writing. Look, there's aluminum, and there's this, it's contraindicated if there's been any history of epilepsy in a family, or...
Yeah. May cause coma, may cause blindness,
death. And the nurses were shocked. They had no idea. The doctors have no idea what's in these things most of the time. And so for anybody out there who has any kind of question, and you really don't know whether your doctor knows, I just have to say, ask your doctor if he's ever read the product insert. Because when I was finished, a lot of, you know, even one of the head nurses turned to me and said, well, I wouldn't give that to my kids. You know, and she was there trying to talk me into it. So, you know.
I don't know why they feel they have to talk you into it. You get this pressure.
No, it's their job. And I think, you know, that the people who have to be sold first are in the medical industry. They're under a lot of pressure. I worked in hospitals, and in my, years ago, and I took flu vaccines while I was there because, you are, I wouldn't say programmed, but in a sense almost programmed. You're there, you believe in the healthcare system, and you're told this is good for you and this will help. And you just can't fathom that maybe somebody hasn't done their science right. And I have to ask you, take this time to ask you about the flu vaccines. Are there any particular alarms? I mean, we're seeing this pushed all over the place, and I'm going, you know, people are getting sick left, right, and center from the flu, and they've been vaccinated, and they're talking about running out of the vaccine. Do you have any opinions on flu vaccines versus all the others?
Well, all I can tell you is that my parents, as I mentioned before, were in an HMO, and they were being pushed to get the flu vaccine. Now, my father's 93, and my mother's, 87 now, and I recommended against it. So that's, you know, it will tell you what my opinion was on it. Now, I will have to tell you, though, that's not, again, a general opinion of mine, as I mentioned before. You just have to weigh the benefits and risk on an individual basis, an individual vaccine basis, an individual patient basis, and so on and so forth. I don't think it's something that we can just accept because the public health gurus claim that this is necessary for the population to protect it.
Yeah, I mean, I'm seeing, you know, they're pushing the hepatitis B vaccine on little kids who aren't going to be sexually active for how long.
I think that's particularly bad. I mean, unless there's a risk there, unless there's either an occupational or environmental risk or familial risk for coming down with some kind of disease, you really shouldn't be doing that, particularly to young children. You know, it's bad enough to have to go through that as an adult if you work in a healthcare center. But as a child, I think it's just outrageous.
Now, we know somebody who actually works in an environmental risk situation with hepatitis B, and he's very concerned because he does tattoos, for example, and he's in a high-risk situation. And he's wondering, you know, if he was to get hepatitis B because he refused a vaccine, is he looking at a death sentence? Like almost what's worse? Are your complications and risks from the vaccine greater than the complications and risks from the hepatitis B?
Well, again, it's very hard to say because there's so much variability, not only variability in the vaccines, but tremendous variability from individual to individual in how an individual will be able to handle either infection by that particular virus or handle a number of other issues. And so, again, it's very, very hard to make a blanket statement.
Yeah, I can sympathize. The problem being is that we're hearing more and more of friends, family members who've had a flu vaccine inoculation and gone into a coma for 2 weeks, or a kid has just gone a whole personality change and is just a different person, and fevers and a lot of adverse reactions. And because humans are so different, then you can't really say, well, this, you have to take it case by case. But in one way, the people really aren't that educated to make that decision, and you kind of got a really nervous feeling like, is the flu going to be worse than the vaccine? And like, that's what we were asking about the hepatitis B, is like, is the disease worse than the cure?
Well, I think it's an easier question to ask with influenza, because this is a disease which, you know, since 1918 has not really killed that many people except the immune compromised and the weak and the very elderly and so on.
Well, let me pose
so there is a risk in certain, you know, parts of the population, but again, you have to weigh the benefits and the risk.
Well, can I ask the question this way then? I was under the maybe misconception that if you were somewhat healthy, giving yourself this shock of aluminum and other things is a one way to trigger your immune system to attack something. But isn't it all right for a human to have the odd flu now and then, that you catch a flu and your immune system combats these different things that come up during life?
Well, I think if you're a healthy person, you can, in general, you can fight off an influenza infection. It might leave you uncomfortable for a week or so, but it generally will take its course. I don't think that's nearly the risk that we're talking about in terms of life-threatening diseases. If you have a life-threatening disease on the horizon, then it does make sense from a public health standpoint to have widespread vaccinations of
and that would be more like a hepatitis type thing.
Yeah, and again, this will strike people in different ways, and some people will be only mildly affected, while other people will be completely incapacitated, and some people might even die. So again, there's tremendous variability in these things. It's very hard to know a priori what would be the right approach, but I think a well-informed public is a good start.
Now, using the hepatitis B vaccine for an example, I'm sure you could use several for an example, do you think that children, and I'm not talking young children, let's say teenage children, do you think there's a much of a higher risk inoculating by age group that way? To me, it seems not necessary, of course, to even inoculate somebody in their teens for hepatitis B unless for some strange reason they're going to be exposed to it. But in that case, are there risks that you wouldn't expect, or have you ever seen or heard of an adult, for example, coming down with autism?
Well, it's generally, attributable to childhood and not necessarily infant, but children, and it can persist up through the teenage years. There are cases that have been reported of adult autism. In fact, you see autistic behavior in adults all the time. You just don't think of it as autism. So that's kind of a gray area. I don't think we really understand the adult autistic behavior as well as we see in children. And I think it's because it's much more extreme in children, and you can follow their developmental processes, and it's so aberrant that it's very obvious there. So I think, again, it can be covered up a little bit better by an adult. But as a child, it's usually pretty damn obvious.
Well, okay. What you mentioned earlier about fibromyalgia and chronic fatigue system, with Gulf War veterans often having children who are autistic, I wonder if possibly these diseases are really very connected, and that an adult might just manifest it differently, having actually developed certain knowledge might bypass things that autism would reflect in a
child.
Well,
I think you're on the right track, but for a different reason than what you mentioned.
Okay.
And again, we're really our systems are really quite different as an adult than they are as a developing child. And as systems meaning, I'm principally talking about the central nervous system. And so there are the really differences in a developing brain, and a brain that's undergoing tremendous change at a very rapid rate, compared to a brain that's more or less fairly static. Although there are some changes going on even in adult brains. So there are differences, there are developmental differences, and I think that these diseases may be more related to the developmental process. But the underlying reasons, of course, that some child or even some adult might come down with autistic behavior are still fairly much unknown. And I think the reason for that is these are complex processes that are multifactorial. It's not just one thing. We can't just say it's a vaccine. And that's, of course, they point towards vaccine safety studies by saying, well, nobody can point to a given vaccine and say that it causes a given disease. Well, the problem is that nobody gets just one vaccine. They end up as a child getting 20 to 25 different vaccines in just a few year period. And so you can't just separate out one vaccine. So, unfortunately, there may be one vaccine, and you give it in a normal schedule that you'd give it, it might be completely safe. But you add on top of that another 20 vaccines and give them all together at the same time, and all of a sudden that one vaccine is no longer safe. So these are the kinds of things that bother me and trouble me when it comes to these safety studies for individual vaccines that are not put in together and studied in a safety program that is real world. In other words, what goes on out there in society, not some rarefied situation.
Right, and these don't take into consideration sometimes the carcinogenic situations that arise. Also, I know that there's often a disclaimer about carcinogens, mutagen properties that could happen with vaccines. So maybe there's other stuff going on that we're not taking into consideration that's being triggered and causing a reaction down the line in family members with children.
Well, here's one of the potential problems that we've looked at, and we've studied a group of autistic children in Central California, actually in San Luis Obispo County. And one of the interesting things there is this is a fairly agrarian county, so the children, if they live in the rural areas, are exposed to a lot of organophosphates, pesticides, and so on that they use on the farms. And so there's a very high incidence of autism in that particular county. So that may be one of the factors, for example, exposure to organophosphates. Another factor could be exposure to microorganisms. Some of these may come in through the vaccines and so on. And a third element may be the heavy metal exposure, not only in the case of vaccines, but also in the environment. And you add all these things together, and all of a sudden, this soup, this toxic soup, may be really the underlying cause, at least in that particular instance, of the very high rate of autism in that particular county. And in fact, when we studied the children, we found that over half of them were contaminated with a particularly vicious microorganism, a mycoplasma, actually two or three different species of mycoplasma, and this alone would attribute a lot of their problems to this type of infection. But they also had these other exposures as well. So, you know, we get all these different toxic exposures, and depending upon the types of exposures that we get, the status of our immune system, the status of our development, and so on and so forth, we could end up with completely different types of diseases, maybe overlapping a bit in their signs and symptoms, but really put in different categories. And I did mention that in the Gulf War families, the adults were coming down with chronic fatigue syndrome and fibromyalgia syndrome, and that was their diagnosis, but the children were primarily diagnosed with autism, even though we found that they had the same infection. And the veterans that came home, they said they had Gulf War illness or Gulf War syndrome. So they had these three different labels on these different groups of patients, and basically we found that they were contaminated with the same microorganism. And so we think that was a very strong contributing factor, but there were other factors as well, because not everyone in the family, for example, came down with the chronic illness. Even though they had a veteran in the family who did have a transmittable infection and was infecting at least some members of the family. So not every member of a family would come down with illness. And actually, we found that the children that were most susceptible were the ones that had more childhood disease. They had a higher frequency of childhood illness compared to their siblings. And their siblings who may have had less illness during their early years were the ones that were the less susceptible to coming down with the infections passed from the veteran and also the diagnosis of autism. So there are a number of factors, including the immune system, other exposures, other things that they come in contact with. So again, these are quite complicated cases, and I think all the chronic illnesses are really quite complicated, and that's probably one of the reasons why haven't made the headway in the chronic illnesses as we've made in acute illnesses, which are often attributable to one or just a few small number of different toxic insults on our body. Chronic illnesses, that's different. There are multiple toxic insults on our body. Some are environmental, some are infectious, some may be things like heavy metals and other things, organophosphates and so on. And you add all this together, and you end up with some kind of an illness. It has an environmental basis, but it also has an infectious basis and so on. These are quite complex, and it's very hard to diagnose them and very, very hard to treat them.
Right. Well, I mean, if you're talking about any kind of a neurologic disorder, there could be multiple factors causing the same thing to go wrong.
That's
so,
correct.
I think
that's why we can't seem to find one underlying cause for any of these chronic illnesses, because there isn't one underlying cause. There are multiple causes, and that's what... You know, it's very hard, and I actually had to make up a slide when I went to even to talk to the environmental physicians, and the slide showed the simplified version, of polioviruses cause polio, but, you know, we know that there are a lot of other illnesses that may or may not be caused by viruses and other microorganisms, but often these have other elements as well, chemical elements, toxic metal elements, and so on and so forth, and they cause these complex illnesses that are very ill-defined or less ill-defined, again, chronic in nature, not acute, so it's harder to identify them, harder to diagnose them, harder to treat them.
Well, I recall reading about a study that identified high levels of mercury in the hair follicles of autistic children, of many of them, not all of them, which would indicate that in some cases that there is a genetic disposition to being unable to flush the toxins from their body. So in a sense, what you're saying, I mean, if there are so many factors involved, it's almost like trying to put together a jigsaw puzzle and find out what triggers are going to actually cause the problem in the first place.
But even a jigsaw puzzle can be mastered, even if it looks complex and the pieces don't look like there's any relationship to one another when you first look at it. Once you start putting them down and grouping them and putting them together and figuring out where they fit, you can put the puzzle together. In the case of some of these chronic illnesses, I think we're beginning to understand the parameters that are important, and we're able to eliminate the parameters, finally, that we think are less important or not important. And so, again, you have to think of this multifactorial approach. And for many researchers and for many physicians, and that's just too much. They just can't handle that. It's just too complicated, and they don't know where to start. And that's unfortunate, but that's the reality of it.
Yeah, I think that happens in a lot of walks of life. There's such an information overload out there that people sort of find their little area where they're comfortable with, and if you try to crowd that area with some other data, it can be shut out. And I wonder, because you've done some exceptional research, and you've got credentials that are very well up there in the research world, from what I understand. And I mean, I'm not a doctor, I realize, but I recall one doctor saying to me, "Oh, he's the fellow that wrote an article about, you know, on a totally different." So you've done a lot of publishing, and your name is fairly well out there. Do you get a lot of people trying to brush off what you're saying from the medical world, or do you find it's mostly of, "Well, I don't really have the time to think about it." You don't really feel they're trying to discredit you, do you, so much as just not
looking? Well, I think it's more out of ignorance than anything else.
Yeah, I guess that's what I'm trying to get at.
Part of the problem is that, for example, the average physician is so busy and only allowed about, at an HMO, less than 5 minutes per patient. They really don't have time to keep up. They have little time, for example, to become current in the medical and research literature and so on. So they depend upon basically summaries that are provided by other physicians and so on, and a lot of them just fall back on their medical training. Now, I know this very well because for 25 years I taught in medical school, so I know what we do to medical students and so on, and so we jam a lot of information down them, but often when they get out of medical school, there's, you know, only a half-hearted effort to keep current. And so they generally, look for what's safe to do and what their other colleagues are doing before they'll think about, some alternatives, and maybe there's something new out there that's better.
Right. Now, are you looking at different ways to produce vaccines that are safer, or are you mostly just focusing on the disease elements and trying to solve that? There's so many fields out there that can be interconnected.
Well, a little of both, and I can't say that the vaccines are my primary work. I mean, generally, when I get involved in that, it's with a colleague who is a vaccine expert and spends 100% of his time trying to develop new and better vaccines. And we're trying to go, again, and make more purified molecular-type vaccines that turn on molecular signals in cells and stimulate them so that we don't have to pour this soup into people that can cause all kinds of side reactions and undesirable things. And it could be contaminated with things like microorganisms, viruses, and bacteria, and so on. We're trying to get away from that and more synthetic-type vaccines that we can control the purity, we can control the content, and we can control the contamination, and I think all that's very important. So in the long run, in the future, and I think when we'll get better and better at doing this, and hopefully vaccines will become safer and safer, but we still have that problem as we're trying to put in so many different vaccines that we're going to have to look at this, I think, from a slightly different philosophy and decide which of them are really important, and maybe there are some that we should eliminate and get rid of because they're of lesser importance and maybe they're not very good. They've been used for years, and we've been, seeing them for years, but maybe it's not a very good vaccine, and maybe there's a much higher than acceptable chance of things like contamination of various different agents and everything that we discussed before, and so there's probably some that need to be retired.
I'm wondering now, something you just said made me wonder if it's possible to create something that's, well, maybe not a vaccine by our common definition, but more something that would trigger the genes to activate some kind of a super fighting ability against generally diseases. And I realize that, of course, that's a miracle answer, holy grail that anybody'd want to find. But do you think there's any real serious research in that? I mean, to me, that might actually
substitute. Well, there is. In fact, the newer vaccines instead of using these more or less general adjuvants, as they're called, which will non-specifically stimulate the immune system, we're getting down to the point where we're going to stimulate very specifically certain genes in certain cell types to help with the immune response. And so hopefully we'll get rid of a lot of the side effects, the side reactions and so on that can occur when you put in this chemical soup into people. So yes, there is a refinement that's going on slowly but surely to try and improve vaccines, make them more specific, make them safer, control the contamination better, and so on and so forth. So eventually I think we will make them better, but we're a long way from that.
So I'm wondering if something like that can be created without actually having to use animal byproducts and actual cell byproducts.
Absolutely. That's what I'm talking about.
Yeah,
I'm
that's
talking
what I, about I was hoping you were
absolutely,
saying that.
Totally synthetic and molecular in nature and bypasses completely the old-fashioned way in which vaccines are made. And some of these are called genetic vaccines and so on because they depend a lot upon actually the genetic code and putting certain genetic sequences into a recipient and so on, so they'll respond in certain ways and trigger certain genes without this wholesale triggering that goes on without all the other contamination and side products and side reactions and so on that go on. So there is an effort to do this, and I think eventually it will be successful, but it's going to be a long time before these are, you know, into use and they replace the old vaccines and so on and so forth. So this is going to take quite a while.
Yeah, but when you're saying genes, then you're going to have to take a sample from each person. Isn't that the kind of thing that would have to happen? You would have to take a blood test or something to get the genetic blueprint to suggest one type of vaccine for one person and not another for another.
Well, you may have to do that eventually, and that would be the best case scenario. And
right.
In fact, we're headed in that direction. But in general, there's some basic genes that we know that are important in the immune response. And everybody has to have these genes, and everybody does have these genes, and these genes have to respond. So we know they're there, we know what the genes are, we know their sequence and so on, and now we're beginning to know how to turn them on very, very specifically. So, you know, I think that there are going to be some genetic differences, but this should bypass many of those differences.
Well, I do look forward to the day when we can pick up a vaccine and see that there is no aluminum, mercury, animal products or anything. And then, well, we can focus on some of our other concerns about genetic tampering. And I think, you know, in the end, it's all part of our evolutionary process. As long as we're not too crazy gung-ho and not thinking about what we're doing a little bit first. But that, what you're talking about sounds to me like a very progressive step and definitely preferable to what we're working with now.
Well, we certainly think it's preferable to what's going on now, but again, it's just going to take time and effort and so on to eventually get these not only to be developed, but also to be tested and finally to be accepted. This is a long, slow process.
Is there
years.
A company or firms that you can just mention that are doing this kind of research?
Well, most of the research actually that we're doing is actually supported by the federal government, by the National Institutes of Health, and you know, so by some other branches, some you know, societies, for example, that which are private foundations that are interested in doing this. So, this is by and large not supported by different companies. They generally have their own programs, although sometimes they use outside research institutions to help with their research efforts. A lot of their work is proprietary and goes on behind closed doors, so we really don't have any direct knowledge of what they do unless they publish it.
And right. Well, we
not very good at publishing it.
So it's fairly wide.
We always publish our results because that's what we do.
Yeah, it would be nice actually if science would go back a little bit more towards that direction where, I mean, it seemed to when the corporations really stepped in there, it became so fractioned and closed off. It was much more open once upon a time where people would comment on each other's work and much more public. And it seems kind of tragic in a sense. But
well, you know, that's one of the things that's happened. The other thing that's happened is that, you know, our FDA is, I wouldn't say it's been taken over, but there's certainly a lot of the inspectors now in the FDA, you know, their salaries are coming actually from the companies that they're supposed to regulate. And so there's a conflict of interest there that's built in and a pressure to approve new drugs, approve new vaccines, so on and so forth. And so this is something that we're going to have to struggle with in the future.
Yeah, and I guess it's really the evolutionary process that's involved with actually becoming a civilized world, and I don't take that word lightly, because I think we've got a long way to really go before we truly reach civilization, but we're trying, right? You're doing awesome work with all of this, and it's great that you're publishing your stuff in an open forum, because it's very hard for people to find experts in this kind of area who are willing to actually discuss what they're talking about without, you know, having to track down some obscure paper or whatnot. So your work has been invaluable, and I know a lot of people make reference to what you're doing.
Well, we put most of our work on our website, which I'll give you the URL is www.immed.org. Just think of immediate.org, immed.org. And if people go on that site, they'll find a lot of information about chronic illnesses, particularly fatiguing illnesses and autoimmune illnesses and degenerative illnesses. There might be some information that could help people.
Now, you actually do treat or try to help people with some of their chronic illnesses, not just research.
Well, our institute actually is a nonprofit research institute, and we don't directly treat patients unless they're part of our clinical trials. And we do run clinical trials, and if patients, fit into those clinical trials and are included in those clinical trials, they will receive treatment, and we do have physicians that are associated with us that do this. But as a rule, we don't encourage people to contact us if, you know, and say, like I have about 10 telephone calls here, can I come down and will you have somebody on your staff, you know, look at me, diagnose me, treat me, or whatever. We don't do that. We're not a clinic. But we do try and validate certain principles with clinical trials, and hopefully this will push the envelope forward.
Okay. Now, certain chronic diseases, such as hepatitis B, this is from a question that's come into us. Are you aware of any treatments, once a person's got this illness, that will actually help?
Really? Well, yes, without getting into details, and I really can't, you know, quote for individual patients what they need to do. They need to, of course, consult their physician, and if their physician can't help them, they need to find somebody who's knowledgeable that can help them in that area. But yes, there are some new treatments out there that can help. There's some new immune-associated treatments, for example, immune-boosting treatments and so on. And there's even some new nutraceuticals out there, and some of these even involving Chinese herbal approaches and so on, that may be very useful, and useful in conjunction with other more standard approaches. So they're both the kind of traditional pharmacological approaches or approaches, and these are now being, I would say, not replaced, but supplemented by new nutraceutical approaches, new natural approaches to solving the same problem. And we try and stress using these together, both what are called allopathic and naturopathic approaches to medicine.
Okay, well, that sounds fairly well balanced, and it's refreshing to hear a doctor such as yourself make reference to naturopathic approaches, because a lot of people get this sense like they're being pulled between worlds, and they're not allowed to dabble in one world lest they offend the other. You know,
well,
what I mean?
One of my positions, I am a professor of integrative medicine, but that doesn't necessarily mean that all the approaches should be that. It's just that you have to weigh various problems and seek solutions that are not always just the conventional solutions. And again, I have to stress that we're researchers, and so our primary concern is the development of new approaches, both diagnostic and treatment, to help patients.
Right, and that is an important distinction, of course, and a refreshing one, too. So you guys are ongoing with your research, and it's very positive to know. Anybody out there who has millions of dollars that they want to leave to a good cause, you want research, you know where to dedicate it.
We're actually a tax deductible organization. We're a 501c3, and so all donations are welcome. We'll put them to good use. And so if somebody wants to make a donation, please, they can deduct it from their taxes.
Wonderful. I really do strongly feel that there ought to be more independent type research established, and I hope that we, as we move away from this corporate centered world that more type situations such as what you've got going start to crop up, because that's how you're going to get your true research done. I don't want to call it garage science, but in a sense it almost is, because that's the only way you can really break away from what you've been told already. You have to be able to take a fresh look, and as you say, look at all things. I'll be the first one to say, if it works, it works. It doesn't matter what area it comes from. You have to be able to look at it in the first place to even find out if it does work, though.
Well, that's exactly right. And one of the I think the really interesting studies that we've done in the last few months looked at a very interesting nutraceutical. This is an all-natural product that was actually developed from soy to repair the membranes of our cells. And it actually is instrumental in repairing the damage that occurs during aging and cancer and other diseases to our mitochondria, which are little batteries inside our cells. And we were just looking at some simple parameters like fatigue, and we could take people that had extreme fatigue, and we could lower their fatigue down to moderate to even mild fatigue by using this nutraceutical product. And they just take this 2-3 times a day. It's a natural product. There's no side effects. Hardly anybody has ever reported any problem with this. And so this is just one of the natural things that's out there now. And unfortunately, the big pharmaceutical companies hate things like this because you can't patent them. They're fairly inexpensive. They're not going to make a lot of profit on it. So they hate it.
Yeah.
So they probably hate us in the process. But I think these things are useful for patients. And if they're useful, we're going to investigate them, and hopefully they'll be used.
Well, that's excellent. So as far as your investigations go currently in the future, are you planning to stick on the same track that you've been on? Do you have anything coming up that you're a deviation from course?
Well, we have some new things that we're working on. I can't talk too much about it, but one of the things today that I was dealing with is really more in the area of pulmonary disease, things like asthma and chronic lung disease and so on. And we have a new study that we're just getting started in that area. And again, this involves a very natural, very safe nutraceutical product that's fairly inexpensive. And I think it's going to be a blockbuster when we get done with the study, from what I've seen. And actually, my wife, Nancy, is taking this right now. And she has intermittent asthma, and she's doing quite well on this. So we know from anecdotal studies that this stuff is very effective. We just have to prove it now in clinical trials. And I think in the future that this will be tremendously helpful for people that have chronic lung problems.
Well, I'll be watching your website, because my mom has asthma, and that's just developed in the last few years, and I know she would just love some help with that one.
Well, we won't have it on the website yet. We're just conducting the studies. We don't put anything on the website unless it's been published in a peer-reviewed journal.
But how long does it take for you to publish when you're doing a study, I imagine?
Well, it depends on how long the study takes and how long it takes to publish, but often there's a year lag before something, when you start a study and actually complete it, write up the paper and get it published. So when you see publications that have just put on, and we've just put some new ones on just within the last few months, the studies were actually conducted a year or more ago. That's just the lag time required to get them published. But we generally will not put anything on the website unless it's published.
Okay. Well, fair enough. Then I'll still keep my eyeball for your new publications as they come out in the next year or two on that one. Well, excellent. I don't know if we've missed anything at this point. Is there anything that you wanted to bring up that we haven't covered?
Well, I did mention our website. Let me say that again. It's www.immed.org. And just think of immediate.org.
Okay.
And actually, I prefer that people do that than try to call us, because we get flooded with telephone calls. We just can't help but, answer them all. And we're a small organization, and we're very heavy in the research end and very light in the administration end, so we don't have many people running around answering the telephones and stuff. So the people in the lab just get overwhelmed when too many people call.
Okay, well, we can put a link to the website there so people can investigate. And I think even from your previous interview, we've got a link up there. So I would like to encourage our listeners also to go back into the archives and have a listen to that first interview. Very, very, very good stuff. I made tapes of your interview and gave it to people to try and educate them a little bit. And very, very useful information.
Well, thanks a lot. And again, we're there to help people, and we try and help as many people as we can. We can't help everybody. And, you know, but again, if we can help, we're glad to try and help. And we get a lot of calls from physicians who need assistance and various types of diagnostic and treatment suggestions and assistance, and we're willing to do that. And again, as a nonprofit organization, we don't charge anybody for this. We depend upon donations. So if anybody out there wants a worthy cause, I think we're it.
Yeah, well, very good. And we will definitely remind our listeners of that now and then.
And to check out your website.
Yes, absolutely. I've been to the website a few times, and I like to just see if there's anything new up there now and then. And thank you so much for coming on the program and talking to us. I know you're very busy, and we had to really rush your schedule a bit today to get you in here. So I, you know, want you to kick back and be able to relax a little bit now that...
Now I have to go to the store and make dinner.
So. Oh, yeah. It's a little bit of a late one for you. Well, thank you again so much for being on and for asking our many questions, or answering our many questions. We would like to talk to you again, actually, in a couple of years, if you have another update and you don't mind chatting.
Well, we always have new updates. And again, we do different things. So we have, different topics that come online at different times. But again, we're primarily concentrating in the areas of chronic illnesses. Chronic meaning anything from fatiguing illnesses, autoimmune illnesses, degenerative illnesses, rheumatic illnesses, things like this. And of course, this is a very broad spectrum, but unfortunately, these types of illnesses are really on the increase.
Right. Okay, well, that's an education for us. And thank you again so much for being with us tonight.
Well, thanks for having me.
Yeah, more than welcome. Everybody, you've been listening to Black Hawk Radio, joined by Professor Garth Nicholson. Very good interview, thank you. And in the studio here with Lynn Osanek and Anita Langley, this was Black Hawk Radio number 152. Thank you very much, everyone, for joining us tonight. And I've got three tongues. I'll have to tip a couple of those off. Good night, everybody.
Thank you again.
You've been listening to Black Op Radio, broadcasting weekly from the Fiasco Brothers Recording Studio in Vancouver, Canada. You're listening to the Fiasco Brothers Radio Network.